friendly China's a strategic competitor. Well, that's true, but it's a much more complex relationship than that. And there's a whole range of issues, whether it's North Korea or Afghanistan or climate change or counter-narcotics. It's a whole range of issues where we still have overlapping interests and should be able to cooperate. But we like to demonize adversaries, and we're pretty good at that.
I'm Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. That was the voice of Bob Manning, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C. By all counts, Bob is a foreign policy expert. He's held positions with the U.S. government, the National Intelligence Council, and the Council on Foreign Relations. In Bob's world and in the work he does, China figures large. I caught up with him over the winter holidays while in the U.S. and asked him to characterize the current state of U.S.-China relations. How much is China's rise to power seen as a threat to the U.S. and other Western countries?
The old consensus, you know, that we can work with China, cooperate where we can, and manage our differences and so on, that's gone. I think this is the first time under Trump, and you know, over five presidents, when an American, in the past, American presidents felt that what was good for China was good for the United States. And that's no longer true. I think trade gets a bum rap, I think, in being blamed for everything. There's no question that the Chinese gamed the system. I think what really happened, which I don't think people are focused on enough, is that when China entered the WTO in 2000, it just took off economically at a pace no one, including the Chinese, expected. Their economy was in 2000 was $1.2 trillion. Their economy in 2016 was $11 trillion plus. So that's a factor of 10. And so we did lose millions of jobs and so on. That's all true. And China did become the factory of the world and all that. That helps explain some of the American attitudes. And you know, at the same time, I think what happened after the 2008 Great Recession, there was a shift in China. The Chinese, I think, mistakenly took that. This is the end of America, the end of capitalist ideology. This is our moment. And China began to abandon the sort of Deng Xiaoping approach and be much more assertive across the board. You may recall the head of their central bank was writing things about how the RMB was going to replace the dollar, and things like this. So it was very cocky, feeling like this is China's moment. And that's when you began to see all the assertive military activity in the South China Sea and the East China Sea, and making these preposterous territorial claims. You know, Chinese fishermen have fished these waters for thousands of years. Of course, there were never any Indonesian or Vietnamese fishermen, right? And things like that. And in the past, when they described their core interests, it was really, you know, Taiwan, Tibet, Xinjiang. And then after that, suddenly their core interests became South China Sea in the same breath as Taiwan and so on. And the system couldn't handle handle that explosion of economic growth.
Yeah, but you pointed out, you know, interestingly, I mean, it did accelerate at rates that nobody expected. You know, I was a graduate student across the street or near you at SAIS in 1989. Nobody saw this coming at this rate. And so in some ways, their reaction seems, frankly, quite understandable. They're proud. It's gone better than expected. They're just acting out the way that any nation would if they were able to rise as quickly and effectively as China has. Isn't that understandable?
Yes, it's very understandable. But the problem for the U.S. is we really have been unable to come to terms with the rise of China in a real sense. I think the economic growth explosion forced the issue, but you know, on security issues, you know, for Asians, if you think back over the last 5,000 years, the Asians have known basically three types of security systems, right? You had the Chinese tributary system, then in the 19th century you had the European and Japanese imperialist system, And then since World War II, you had this American predominance underpinning security and economic growth. But for most Asians, for us, that's a norm. The world's always been that way.
Right.
But for most Asians who have a much longer memory, it's an anomaly. And so the combination of China rising and uncertainty about the U.S. has led everybody in Asia ahead. Accelerated. Now under Trump, it's gone on steroids, hedging against uncertainty. For the U.S., you saw it in the national security strategy. Suddenly, China's a strategic competitor. Well, that's true, but it's a much more complex relationship than that.
Yes.
And there's a whole range of issues, whether it's North Korea or Afghanistan or climate change or counter-narcotics. It's a whole range of issues where we still have overlapping interests and should be able to cooperate. But we like to demonize adversaries, and we're pretty good at that.
Yes.
And I think that's what's happened to China. I mean, and I think it really caught the Chinese by surprise that there's suddenly a bipartisan consensus. They have no friends in this town.
Right.
I think what probably really had an impact on them, I don't know how much attention it got in the region, but last November, about a month ago, the former Secretary of Treasury Hank Paulson gave a speech in Singapore at a conference in which the Chinese were there also. Now, he created a whole institute to cooperate and have more economic engagement with China. Hmm. He was the point man under President Bush for China. And he gave this just devastating speech, basically repeating the litany of grievances against Chinese trade and investment practices, and basically said, we're about to have an iron curtain descend over the economy of the region.
Right.
And he was asking, why is it that people like me, businessmen who have thrived and lived in China, are suddenly supporting these very tough measures against China? And I think the point was that the game is over. And I think we're seeing it. The Huawei episode, I think, is emblematic. It's not just the U.S. I mean, Huawei's been ejected now from Australia, New Zealand, Canada. Japan's moving in that direction. Banks are starting to rethink because of the indictment and the use of HSBC to get around sanctions with Iran. And so I think more, and even within the WTO, even though Trump's tactics of hitting everybody with tariffs rather than having an actual target have irritated their allies, I think if you talk to the Japanese, Europeans, Australians, they all have a pretty common view that Chinese behavior is just unacceptable.
Well, and I,
we can't.
Yeah, and I want to draw a distinction between behaviors and tactics versus the overarching theme of commerce versus politics, because, it appears mm-hmm. that when China proved itself economically successful without democratic freedoms, U.S. policymakers, Western policymakers, turned critical. The fact that China is succeeding without full-blown political reforms is received by some in the U.S. as a slap in the face. Why is that? I mean, it feels honestly like it's like, corporations aren't making the profits. They're not getting that cheap manufacturing base they once had. Forget the benefits to the U.S. consumers and global consumers because of China's presence and their participation. Nobody seems to talk about that and all the cheap goods that were available. But it does feel like, now that, China's bigger and stronger and more competitive, well, we're just not happy. So now we're going to make a stink. What do you think?
Well, you have to unpack that a little bit.
Yeah.
I think there's a couple of different things going on. One is that I think as China has gotten stronger economically, it's adopted. If you look at the polls by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, European Chamber of Commerce, over the last 5 years, you'll see they've found it increasingly difficult to do business with China. If I had to pick an inflection point, I would say after the 2008 financial crisis, China's become more assertive. They thought we've gotten by hook and crook a lot of what we need. We don't need the West anymore. We can do it ourselves, kind of attitude. And that's irritated a lot of businessmen. On the political side, I think you have to, there's a big difference. That Americans had what I think were naive assumptions, not entirely unfounded, right? If you look at the patterns in Asia going back from the 1970s on, what you saw was as middle classes grew, as Asia got more prosperous, you saw political change everywhere. Philippines, Korea, Taiwan, Thailand, although that's regressed, and so on, Mongolia. And so it was not unreasonable. I mean, people were writing articles saying, well, when the middle class, average GNP reaches X level, I don't know what the number was, 10 or 12,000, you get democracy almost mechanically. So those are those kind of assumptions that China blew out of the water.
Mm.
In fact, I would argue that China's gone back the other way. I think Xi Jinping really has, so far, how sustainable it is, I know, but he's really launched a third revolution.
Right.
He's changed the social contract in the past in China. As long as you stay out of politics, you could have all the sex, drugs, and rock and roll you wanted. And there's a lot of personal freedom. Now you have this kind of digital Orwellian system he's created.
Mm.
A lot of Chinese think tank guys that I come across over the last several years are increasingly depressed. They can't travel as much as they did. They're nervous about writing things. But that said, I think that there's a debate. There's clearly a debate in China. You see it every once in a while with some prominent guy will post an article that will last a few hours and get pulled down.
Mm.
But the economic reformers are arguing, the new statism, the new enhanced statism that Xi is pursuing is not working, that in order for their economic reforms, I mean, even by their own standards, if you look at what they've said, the 19th Party Congress, the most fundamental point of the 19th Party Congress was markets should be the decisive factor in the allocation of resources.
Yeah.
They have done the opposite of that.
I'm Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. I'm speaking with Bob Manning, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C. Bob has made a name for himself reflecting on some of the big geopolitical shifts in our time and its impact on the U.S. Getting his perspective on the changing temperament in Washington vis-a-vis China is a subject of our discussion. Influencing change are big business interests. I asked Bob to what degree U.S. corporate lobbying has influenced the shift in foreign policy. Let's get back to our conversation.
You mentioned, the American Chambers of Commerce being polled and saying it's harder to do business in China now than ever before. Isn't that kind of like polling the Vatican and saying, do you think Roman Catholicism is the best form of religion? I mean, in some ways, of course, they're going to complain. And they know if they've got ears in Washington and people, kind of government and policymakers and congressmen will get behind them to kind of like get tough, they're going to get a result. Why wouldn't you respond that way in some ways?
I'm saying is if you go back over the years, I don't think it's ever been, the mood has really changed. There's a much less optimism about doing business in China.
Mm.
And so you have this talk of economic divorce, which I think is overblown. But and nonetheless, it's a measure of the frustration. I am still cautiously, I'm in the minority, I'm cautiously, and I emphasize the caution part, optimistic, that the changes China needs to make to sustain economic growth overlap a lot with a lot of the demands the U.S. is making.
Mm.
And so I think there's a fair probability one measure to me is Trump has just been, poking them in the eye one time after another.
Mm.
That's just a Huawei. We're indicting all these hackers and so on. I mean, in the past, the Chinese would have gone bonkers over stuff like that.
Mm.
They've been very restrained. I was afraid with the Huawei thing, they would respond the way they did. You may remember in 2012, when they unleashed anti-Japanese populism,
yeah,
for boycotting businesses and so on.
Mm.
So I've been waiting for the don't eat at McDonald's, don't buy an iPhone, you know. And if you on the Chinese chat scene, a lot of people are saying that, and there's a lot of anger, and they don't understand what an independent judiciary is. So there's a lot of conspiracy theories about the Huawei case. So I think that I wouldn't be at all surprised. It's not going to be easy, and it won't happen in 90 days. But I think we may be on a path towards a more reciprocal economic relationship, and that's really sort of the key principle of it.
So it's working in your mind. These types of pressures, you know, whether they are coordinated or not, appear to be having an effect on the Chinese leadership. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, I'm saying to the degree that there's a kind of united front in U.S., Europe, Japan, Australia, and others. You know, look, if you're Chinese big tech, for example, if you're Alibaba or Baidu or Tencent, you see the world not that differently from Google and Amazon, right? You global players, you want access to global markets. And yet suddenly the Chinese are seeing themselves shut out of markets. Europe, the United States, Japan are shutting down acquisitions of tech startups and things. And they're uncomfortable. I'm sure they've gone to Xi and say, you know, hey, boss, this ain't working too well. We're only 14% of the world economy. We need access to the other 86%.
Hmm.
And so I think that's part of what's going on. And I think more broadly, the way they had their standard stimulus, which is funneling money into state-owned enterprises and at the expense in the last year or two of private sector, is really holding back Chinese private sector investment. And that's what's been driving growth in China. And just in the last month or two, they've had, I don't know how they'll be implemented, but they had new directives, you know, urging banks to have a higher proportion of lending to the private sector. I think because there's so much censorship at a new level in China, the debate is more opaque to us. But I sense that there's something going on in China that I don't know how it will play out.
So
because she has sort of staked everything on his total control,
yeah,
and the communist partyization of everything. My favorite one is, you know, they go to the WTO and want to be accepted as a market economy at the same time as they're telling every company, including foreign companies, they have to have Communist Party members on their boards.
Yeah.
You know, hello.
Well, I understand, right? But it's almost like we set the rule book. These are the rules. You're going to play by rules. And if you start to tweak those rules, even though times have changed, things have shifted, artificial intelligence, machine learning, robotics are entering, there's all these shifts in the economy. And we don't like the fact that they're, you know, rewriting the rules to some degree. So Americans, for instance, don't like the fact that the Chinese government supports, subsidizes, or invests in their corporate champions. The U.S. held similar complaints with some European companies in recent years. Airbus comes to mind, right? But this time around, why does it feel so much more contentious with the Chinese than it was with the Europeans? I mean, it really does feel like neo-Cold War with them versus, right?
Yeah. I think there's a difference. Like, if you look at the Made in China 2025, it was basically modeled on Germany's Industry 4.0.
Yes.
But with two big differences.
Mm.
These massive subsidies to national champions and to preventing competition in a whole range of tech sectors. Those are really the grievances that the Trump people are pushing. And I think my view is they don't have to get everybody. Every country has industrial policy of one sort or another. That's not the Made in China 2025 per se, in the sense that it's aspirational that they want to move up the value chain. That's understandable. The question is how you do it. And the way they're doing it is just unacceptable.
You're listening to Inside Asia and my conversation with Washington, D.C.-based Bob Manning. In the second part of our conversation, I press Bob on the subject of Chinese aspirations versus U.S. criticism. What's behind the rhetoric? Is it commercially or politically motivated? And to what degree is U.S. big business simply looking to twist the arms of its lawmakers to rein in the Middle Kingdom?
My view is, instead of whining about China, we should be figuring out how to compete with them.
Well, bingo. I agree. And I think that it doesn't feel like that, though. It feels like, you know, we're throwing up walls and actually playing, you know, using some of the same devices of getting government to interfere in commercial deals, for instance, blocking Chinese acquisitions as U.S. companies. I mean, that's what we've been complaining about, you know, not being able to have fair and equal access to the China market. We're kind of borrowing a page from their playbook. Right.
Well, I mean, I would say, as I say, a lot of that is designed to put pressure on them so that we do have a more reciprocal relationship. But the point is, you know, we're in the middle of at the beginning of a massive technology revolution that's going to change the world far more than the last 20 years of internet and the app economy. And the U.S. is not responding to it.
Yes.
Our training and education, there's a gap in skills. If you talk to a lot of companies, we're not responding to that. We're still producing lawyers and not mathematicians and then engineers.
Right.
And then we're even more stupidly, if you look at the number of PhDs, how many of them are Indian or Chinese versus American?
Right.
And then on top of that, then we cut back H-1B visas. So we're training all these brilliant engineers and scientists and then sending them home to compete against them.
Crazy, right? Absolutely crazy.
I'm saying. There's no national strategy for how to compete. At certain levels, the DOD has figured it out. They're doing a big push into integrating with Silicon Valley and investing in AI and all this sort of thing. But at a popular level, it doesn't pervade our culture or our society. We're still very complacent.
Well, there
and
it
I
is.
That's as big a problem as Chinese practice.
Well, I'm glad you raised this because it does feel to me very similarly that, you know, let's get our game on and start to compete and start to really take it to them in ways that the U.S. and the Western world has been able to do before. But there seems to be this whining, complaining, I'm not getting my way. I'm not getting my share. You know, it's not happening for me anymore. And we know, you know, you look at the trend line on this, U.S. corporations, whether it's through share buybacks or all kinds of financial manipulation, are finding it harder and harder to eke out those profits. You know, the cost of labor is stabilized in China. You can go to other developing markets, or you can invest in robotics and other type of artificial intelligence and other capabilities to compete and bring those costs down, or not, right? So it just feels to me a little bit like, you know, we're complaining about China, who is really doing nothing more now than what we did at the turn of the century in the Industrial Revolution. We've gotten momentum.
Go back even further.
Yeah.
Alexander Hamilton was stealing British technology for steam engines. I mean, so
perfect.
Alexander Hamilton's paper on manufacturers.
Perfect.
That was all about that.
Right.
Yeah, so there's nothing new here.
Yeah. Yeah, so we can go and do it, but you know, hey, when it's your turn, you know, we're not comfortable with it. I get the lack of comfort.
Fair, I mean, you know, they the problem is also, I think Xi Jinping has a serious credibility problem.
Mm.
You know, he pledged to Obama that there would be no more IPR theft. Well,
yeah.
it seems to be on the rise. 3 years later, if you recall, he pledged they would not militarize the South China Sea.
Mm.
How'd that work out?
Yeah,
and you know, and even he goes to Davos and talks about globalization and free trade, and it's sort of free trade for China everywhere else, but you can't invest in our industries that we're trying to develop.
Yeah, well, I would just say they learned well from the United States, is what I would say.
They brilliantly. That's the problem.
Yeah,
and they've also learned about the hypocrisy of our ideology.
Bingo.
Right.
Right.
they've watched us say rules-based order, but we don't want to go invade Iraq. That's okay.
Exactly. Right.
And
right.
And so they're saying, well, you know, it's about power. Well, we can do that now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's
it. So, I think that's part of what's going on.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm with you. I mean, you know, we all want to live in a world where, you know, we operate by the rules and there's, you know, upside for everybody and win-win propositions and, you know, no stealing intellectual property, you know, demilitarizing wherever possible. Mm-hmm. Nobody's advocating. But I am pointing out that I do believe that, you know, we should perhaps hold up the mirror when I say we, the Americans and the American policymakers, to say, you know, these methods are things that are basically the Chinese are doing to get ahead now while they can, because they don't know when there's going to be a folding in on what's been allowed to date and when America stops being that kind of trading partner it's been for the last 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, there's something to that, but I guess to me, you know, you also have to, I think, I mean, this may be unfair, but no one has benefited more from the rules-based order that the United States has underpinned mm-hmm. than China.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I say to my Chinese friends, where would you be now without Richard Nixon on the get blank stairs? They know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there's not, it's only not gratitude. They're still got this century of humiliation chip on their shoulder. And I guess my view is they've had an enormous amount of success. And they need to grow up. They need to start acting more like a mature great power. And okay, they gained the system. They got where they are. Now I think the world is telling them you can't do that anymore. I mean, the problem now is that the biggest enemy of the rules-based system is Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of people in the U.S. and Europe and elsewhere are very concerned. We may not have a WTO a year from now. Right.
Right. Right. Exactly.
So these institutions need to be updated. And, you know, in some cases we have. I mean, one of my, in the financial realm, think about it. After 2008, the G20 reforms, suddenly China had more votes in the IMF. They had more senior personnel in the IMF.
Mm-hmm.
The RMB was in the basket of currencies. So in that one area, the system did adapt, but we haven't done that writ large. That's the problem.
Mm.
We haven't updated the system to reflect the diffusion of power in the world, and that's hard enough to do, even if you know what you're doing. But if you have Captain Chaos as president, that's pretty tough.
Yes.
And I think that's a lot of concern. And that's how you allow Xi Jinping to run around the world claiming to be the champion of globalization, because the U.S. is, you know, they got these really scary views to me about they oppose what they call globalism. And they, you know, Mike Pompeo gave a speech a few weeks ago in Brussels that I found really disturbing. It was about, you know, we have to exercise our sovereignty in these multilateral groups. We don't think too much of them. And it was, to me, a lack of understanding about the whole post-war order.
Yes.
We created the post-war order for two reasons. We just had a horrible depression and we didn't want another one. And we just had a second world war and we didn't want to have another war. So we created this system of alliances and Bretton Woods institutions, and they worked pretty well for a long time. Now they need to be, you know, updated and modernized, and we're not really rising to the challenge.
Well, Bob,
that's a real problem. And if you listen to Trump and what their policies are saying, to me, it's a trajectory that's taking us back to the 1930s.
Well, Bob, there it is.
Hobbesian view of the world, everybody for themselves. There's no such thing as cooperation. When in fact, the point is they don't understand that these institutions are an example of where you pool your sovereignty because you have common interest for your own benefits.
So these
we didn't create these things because we were nice guys and do-gooders.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, this is, you're raising some really interesting points. And I guess, you know, these are signals. These are shots across the bow of the world saying, you know, we see the world differently. We're going to act in our own self-interest. We're not going to honor the institutions that have been established post-World War II. We have a different view about, you know, America first. Well, you know, the Chinese are smart. They're listening. They're watching this. And obviously, if the world's power is saying these kinds of things, what are you going to do? You're going to basically throw up, you know, the walls, you're going to gird your loins, you're going to get ready for battle, and you're going to try to be more self-sufficient and self-reliant, right? It's only natural.
They know that they benefit from the system, and now they want to be the champion of it because we've walked away from it.
Yeah.
We've basically thrown away a winning hand, right? Think what the world would look like now if we had concluded TTIP with the Europeans, concluded TPP. We'd be in a position where China would be forced to come to terms with our rules.
Absolutely.
And we walked away from that.
Yeah.
We threw it in the trash. And it's just many of us were saying at the time it's a huge strategic mistake, and you're handing the world to China, and that's to some extent what's happened.
This is Inside Asia. You've been listening to my conversation with Bob Manning, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council, a leading think tank in the heart of Washington, D.C. This brings us to the Asia Insider Minute, that part of the program where I do my best to distill some of the key takeaways from the conversation you've just heard, and maybe add a few thoughts of my own. If you're wondering why we spend so much time on the program addressing U.S.-China relations, it's because we believe it serves as a bellwether for a shifting world order. While China flexes its newfound geopolitical muscles with sights fixed fast on global markets, the moon, and more, the U.S. appears mired in a crisis of national confidence. U.S. headlines these days speak less of global outlook and more of walls and protectionism. Indeed, the American pioneering spirit appears to be beating a retreat. And at the risk of oversimplifying things, it is the juxtaposition of China versus the U.S. that symbolizes to the world an inevitable shift in power. These days, it's downright fashionable to criticize China. In the U.S. Capitol's corridors of power, there's no love lost for the People's Republic. Arrogant, overreaching, hegemonic are all words to describe China and its preeminent leader, Xi Jinping. It's not so much what China does, but how it does it that gets other world leaders up in arms. With respect to the U.S., it's a matter of national ego, if there even is such a thing. What the U.S. really appears to want is a handshake and a thank you from the Chinese leadership. Everything they are today is because of the U.S., chided one foreign policy analyst I spoke to recently, who felt that China was simply ungrateful to the rest of the world for letting it join the World Trade Organization and the Fellowship of Free Trade. Talk about arrogance! My guest, Bob Manning, is more conciliatory. While he, too, sees legitimate reason to criticize China for gaming the system to get what it wants commercially and politically, he feels that the U.S. would do well to first get its own house in order. Instead of whining about China, he says, the U.S. should be figuring out how to compete with them. That's good advice. Squabbling won't change things, and it certainly won't help us contend with some of the more pressing issues of our time, like poverty, disease, terrorism, and climate change. Nationalism is all well and good. In some ways, it forms the basis of a healthy rivalry and innovation, but it can also prove a deterrent to aligning in the interests of a healthier planet. We've talked about China's rise to power in previous episodes, and I invite you to join us at www.insideasiapodcast.com. There you can find and download conversations with leading thinkers and China experts. In recent weeks, I've talked to Liz Economy at the Council of Foreign Relations. We discussed the Huawei fiasco and how it represents a state of foreign policy confrontation. I've touched on all issues related to trade as well, in conversations with Jim McGregor, Steve Okin, Wendy Cutler, and many others. Tech in China is another big theme, and for more on that, check out episodes featuring Fortune's Clay Chandler and the Conference Board's David Hoffman. The subject of China is here to stay, and in the weeks and months ahead, we hope to enrich the conversation from as many perspectives as possible. Until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia.